back together again. You and I wrapping up another busy month on Thursday, August the 31st, 2023 on Connecticut Today. We featured Only in Bridgeport blogger Lenny Grimaldi, who raised his concerns about a Hearst, Connecticut media story regarding a Bridgeport absentee ballot issue. We also had our monthly check-in with noted columnist Chris Powell. The website and the blog onlyinbridgeport.com. Lenny Grimaldi is with us. Lenny, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I am here, Uncle Paulie. I'm suited up and ready to go with the penultimate weekend
to the primaries.
Nice.
That's right. So listen, before we get to what you'll be eating and drinking on the weekend and any primary news here, you wrote a piece, I see this, and you are questioning, Lenny, the timing of the story that a lot of people are talking about, including me on the air here, these alleged improprieties from 2019 and possible criminal referrals. What's your point of view on that?
My point of view is the Hearst story, the Connecticut Post story, was a complete, calculated, irresponsible ambush. Less than 2 weeks from a Democratic primary for mayor. I have no issue if a news organization doesn't like a politician, all right? And they obviously don't like Joe Gann, and they haven't for years. But show some fairness. And there's no fairness in the story. So let me bring people back. This story that they wrote is 4 years old. So in 2019, Joe Gannon defeated State Senator Marilyn Moore in a tight primary for mayor. Gannon won. So Moore operatives filed a lawsuit claiming that there was some impropriety involving absentee ballots. Mm-hmm. The Connecticut Post went out and scoured neighborhoods and tried to find some information about, you know, was there any of these, you know, funny business going on with AB. So I wrote a story about it that, you know, it's kind of the usual kind of story in Bridgeport politics.
Okay.
And there were a lot of inaccuracies in that reporting. Now, let's fast forward, okay, to June of 2023. So we went through all of 2020, all of 21, all of 22, into 23. And the State Elections Enforcement Commission in June decided that, you know, there's enough here that we went out and quote unquote authorized staff lawyers to refer evidence of possible criminal violations undertaken from the 2019 race.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Connecticut Post has been patting itself on the back about this story for so long. They're suffering from back lacerations. I mean, it's like over and over the way they couch this story. But here's the thing that is really annoying, and 2 points. And so on the day, the very day, M&T Bank announces a bank branch for the East End of Bridgeport has been dying for a bank branch for 20 years. They decided this was a much bigger story. So I'll go back to your question at hand.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the problem. You know, Marilyn Moore complains about absentee ballots. But here's the point that the Connecticut Post doesn't include in the story. Marilyn Moore in 2019 hired a woman who 1 year earlier pled guilty to multiple felony violations in conjunction with absentee ballots. That's a fact. Also a fact that Marilyn Moore was the only mayoral candidate in 2019 to be fined by the State Elections Enforcement Commission for election violations. They don't report that. So you got to have some balance in this stuff. You just can't go out because a lot of people, and unfortunately, they believe this stuff. So that's my beef.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to write the story? Why are you writing it now? They rule on this in June.
So
why are you writing about it now?
Are you saying, Lenny, that this is a concerted effort by them, or concerted or not, to take out Joe Gannon?
Absolutely. They wanted. So who did the Connecticut Post endorse in 2019? Marilyn Moore. So after Gannon beat her in the primary, they endorsed Moore in the primary. So Moore ran as a writing candidate. They even endorsed her as a writing candidate without doing any background, any vetting of who this person is, what her background. Now, we've learned a lot more about Marilyn Moore, that she's just an ineffective, disorganized candidate. Now, the thing about being a state senate, it's the coziest job in the world. Wouldn't you like to have that?
Mm-hmm.
All you do is, once you get elected to that, all you do is make friends. And you stay there mostly forever. But when you start running on a much wider level for the mayor of Bridgeport, the blemishes are going to show, right? But the post is very narrow-minded, so focused on taking out Joe Ganim that they write these stories, and there's probably going to be more. It's just a question of fairness, and there's no fairness in this reporting at all.
All right. The website, onlyinbridgeport.com. The guest is Lenny Grimaldi. We shift to a piece you wrote, Lenny, a few days ago, and I do want to talk to you about the M&T situation momentarily.
Sure.
But you wrote a piece, and you were quite pointed in that piece as well regarding the Bridgeport Generation Now and the Working Families Party. Talk about that.
Oh, great. That's a great point. So the Working Families Party, which is a very far-left liberal organization that tries to push Democrats left to meet their agenda, you know, they've got a toehold in state politics here and there. Not statewide, but, you know, they cherry-pick what they want to do. So 4 years ago, they did endorse Marilyn Moore for mayor. And she had when Ganim beat her in the primary, she had a ballot spot running on the Working Families Party line, but Marilyn Moore flubbed the signature process, which led her fine. She inappropriately circulated signature petitions, which led to that fine. And so, as we spoke about, Moore failed to qualify with the backing of the Bridgeport Generation Now to qualify for the ballots. I mean, she was... You know, she needed, you know, a certain amount of signatures, about 2,100 signatures or so to make the ballot, and she was far short of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so she's not in the Democratic primary, and, you know, she's got no place to go. So the Working Families Party announced over the weekend, we're not endorsing anyone for mayor after endorsing her in 2019. And this really goes to the heart of, why should we put resources behind an inept candidate? You know, if she had made the ballot, that would be one thing, but we're going to endorse her when she's not even on the Democratic primary? So they just said, you know what, we're walking away from this. And, you know, Moore shot back at them, how dare you do this, and Bridgeport Generation Now, you know, on Now Votes are saying, you know, that's just terrible, WFP is done, and blah, blah, blah. And it's all a bunch of, you know, happy... horse poopies.
Yeah. Before we get to the bank, what do you make, Lenny, of John Gomes telling or asking or approaching the Lamon Daniels camp and the Marilyn Moore camp saying, hey, let's just all get together and rally around me?
Well, it's smart. It's smart politics. It's not going to happen. Not before the primary anyways. You know, I don't see Moore endorsing him or, you know, Lamon Daniels endorsing him. If they do, it would be a surprise. And if they do, is there enough time to really, you know, galvanize the anti-vote?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. So, I mean, I look at this primary. You know, primaries are so much difficult to gauge in Bridgeport, you know, than decades ago, because the whole ball of wax now is the primary. So, you know, for the most part. I think, you know, it's just, you know, this is one of those races where it potentially could be close, or, you know, one person winning handily. It's really a question of identifying your vote and dragging it out. And that's what these things, you know, come down to. And, you know, as Bridgeport elections go, there hasn't been much like hand-to-hand combat, meaning, you know, charges and countercharges. you know, I mean, usually like, you know, I look at politics as like a rat's nest of infighting, backstabbing,
you want,
and double
deal. We don't want like steel cage death matches, like coming off the top rope. Yeah, coming off the top rope. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, with stilettos. You know.
Yeah.
So, but it's been kind of like, so I think the Gomes campaign is this: they're staying positive, and they're using an affiliation with another political organization, another PAC called Bridgeport Now. Not Bridgeport Generation Now Votes, but Bridgeport Now. So a bunch of pro-Gomes people organized this PAC. you know, many, many months ago to raise some money, and they're going to use that money to attack Ghanem. You know, Ghanem's going to has a lot of financial firepower to answer back.
Oh, yeah, sure.
He's got plenty of firepower to answer back, you know, and plus the Democratic Town Committee as well, which is backing him, and the usual, you know, political insiders. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see how this shakes out in 10 days. And, you know, this is where it's all about. You know, I say it's, you know, it's less than 2 weeks, but it's really more like starting tomorrow, you're kind of like a week out, because everything you do for the next week, you know, has to be situated for the Monday and Tuesday before, when your whole focus is on identifying your vote and dragging it out. Mm-hmm. I will say this. I think one thing where Ghanem will likely have a strong edge is in absentee ballots, and both sides are working it because the state has made it much easier
to
vote by absentee ballot.
Yeah, it's essential.
We're not talking about absentee funding business. We're talking about simply that the state has said, even if you fear being sick.
That's it. That's all you need.
You can vote by You can vote by absentee ballot.
Yeah,
so
we have de facto mail-in balloting. Lenny, finally, in about the minute we have left, talk to us about this M&T Bank branch that's going to open up.
It's huge for the East End. You're talking about a section of the city that has suffered for a very long time and has been saying, what about us? They haven't had a bank branch for decades. You know, they haven't had a healthcare facility there. They don't even have a supermarket. But all that's going to change. What the whole jump point of this is the Honey Locust Square development along the Stratford Avenue corridor, which is going to include a supermarket, it's going to include a pharmacy, a healthcare facility, and a restaurant. So it was actually Ghanem and others who pitched M&T Bank many, many months ago to why don't you situate a bank branch for the East End of Bridgeport? And yesterday, you know, they made that announcement, and that is a huge piece of information for the people of East End, because now you're seeing, for the first time in a long time, a real synergy that's coming together for that neighborhood that is a food desert and a financial desert.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean, the food desert thing? That means there's no grocery store there, but that's going to change. You know, it's under construction. And sometime in early 2024, you're going to have a grocery store, a bank branch, a pharmacy, a healthcare facility, a restaurant.
Yeah.
So a real place for the East End to use as a jump point for something even more positive.
Yeah, basic stuff that no other neighborhood really thinks twice about. The website, of course, only at Bridgeport.com. Lenny Grimaldi, the guy. Lenny, thank you. Behave this weekend, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, I'll see. I've got to, you know, stay around for another week to hang out and talk.
All right, buddy. Yep, take care. To sort out manners of other mess, because he's so good at doing that, statewide columnist Chris Powell joins us. Chris, good afternoon, sir, and how are you?
I'm good, Paul. Thanks for having me.
You don't have any loose absentee ballots floating around.
You know, you prompted me to start writing a column on that subject.
Because
there's a good example here.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to have a constitutional amendment on the ballot in Connecticut next year on whether we want to amend the Constitution to allow so-called no-excuse absentee voting.
Yeah.
And that would mean, you know, you don't have to be sick to get an absentee ballot. You don't have to be out of state. You can just decide that you don't want to go to the polls. It's too inconvenient, so you want to vote by an absentee ballot by mail. And the Bridgeport situation with, you know, the 2019 primary that now may be under new investigation, that is a reminder to us that the more you separate people from the physical casting in person of their ballots, the more corruption you're going to have in elections. If you allow massive absentee balloting where, you know, everybody, you know, never has to go to the polls, they can, you know, just get a Ghanem campaign worker knocking on their door and giving them a ballot and filling it out for them and mailing it for them, you know, then you're going to Bridgeportize the whole state with no excuse absentee balloting. And I think that's what, you know, this latest news is going to remind us of, I hope.
Yeah. Well, Chris, I'm glad this jogged you to start writing that, because I can't wait to read what you may write on that. So we'll look forward to that. Before we get to your new column, actually the weekend column, you have one today that's interesting. And God bless you, Chris, because a lot of the stuff that you mentioned in this column about the annual, you know, breastfeeding and hand-wringing about insurance rates over and over again, and nothing really changes.
Yeah, the medical insurance in Connecticut is, you know, going up by another 15% or 20%, depending on the policies that people have, and everybody is blaming everybody else for it. The hospitals, you know, blame the insurance companies. The insurance companies blame the doctors and the hospitals. There was a hearing before the insurance department a week ago. Nothing really came out of it. The Attorney General made a good point, I thought, William Tong. He said the insurance companies are raising their rates based on their own mere estimates of what they think medical cost inflation is going to be, and they don't really have any hard data for it. This is a big and controversial issue, and the General Assembly should be investigating this, not just the insurance department. And that they assign it to the insurance department, I think, really means that it's too controversial for elected officials to touch. I mean, the hospitals and the insurance companies employ a lot of people, and on the other hand, a lot of every legislator's constituents are patients who have hospital bills or insurance bills. And medical insurance in the United States now is just a big game of cross shifting, and things have been set up so that you never know who's paying for what and what anything really costs. And I blame the state and the government generally, because it's the government's intervention that began this cross shifting that has made it so confusing. And government cross shifting is in large extent, I think, is what is driving costs up. You know, Medicare and Medicaid, they pay discounted rates to hospitals and doctors. Well, how do hospitals and doctors recover that? They recover it by charging more to everybody else who's not on Medicare and Medicaid. But it's a complicated issue, but it's all cost shifting. It's all confusing. I think you have to start by blaming the government for that.
And Chris, you never get a straight answer. At least I don't. Maybe you've seen something that I haven't. When you have a hospital CEO or somebody in front of the General Assembly or in front of Congress, just ask them a simple question. Why are you charging X amount for that X-ray or that MRI on a machine that you bought 15 years ago that has been paid for 10 times over? And why is my knee X-ray or my arm MRI, you know, being billed at $3,000 or $4,000? It's maddening.
Well, part of it is cost shifting. You know, you may be charged more because I'm on Medicare and they're charging me less.
Yeah.
So there's some unpleasant truths here, and I understand why legislators don't want to face up to it. But if you want insurance rates to come down, we're going to have to do things that are unpopular. You know, state government. I think the state government has 64 mandates on medical insurers saying you've got to cover this, you got to cover this, you got to cover this. A lot of these things are not necessities. I had a chuckle the other day. It's not a state government mandate on insurers, but it's a state government mandate on itself. State government has signed a contract with the state employee unions that requires state government to pay for erectile dysfunction treatments. And there was a news report the other day saying that state government is paying $1 million a year for erectile dysfunction drugs for state employees and retirees. Well, you know, I want them to have a good time as much as anybody else does. But are ED drugs necessities to, you know, for matters of life and death? Of course not.
That is a good point, Mr. Powell. The website, ChrisPowellColumn.com, ChrisPowellColumn.com. Now, start of the school year, you have a column coming out. I know, Chris, you're very passionate about this. The problems we still have are the achievement gap in this state between the cities and some suburbs at times that are only one or two towns away.
Yeah, I think the main point here, Paul, is that, you know, no matter how much we increase spending, we're not reducing the achievement gap, and we're not increasing anybody's learning according to the proficiency testing we're getting. I don't think there's any relation now between spending and performance. But we have a more immediate problem is that many school districts simply can't hire enough teachers. And people increasingly are getting out of the teaching profession, and people who are looking for jobs increasingly decide they don't want to be teachers, which used to be pretty good jobs. Now, why is this? I think it's mainly because people know, teachers see, and outsiders know that schools don't enforce standards anymore, not just academic standards. They don't enforce disciplinary standards anymore. You know, if the police are called to arrest a student, it's an outrage about the educators. It's not an outrage about the student's behavior. It's an outrage that, oh, you're trying to enforce standards in the school system. Teachers are giving up on teaching, and people are giving up on teaching, entering teaching, because students are increasingly disruptive and misbehaving, and even assaulting teachers. I mean, I think that is a big reason, probably the primary reason why so many school systems can't hire teachers now, and they're trying to make do with temporary substitutes.
One of the things that was suggested, Chris, I think it might have been Kate Diaz who's been on this show. I think she's the head of the CEA. She said, she kind of spoke, and I spoke to her regarding this very thing. And remember, she put forward that, well, the only way you're going to get teachers to teach if they're hesitant is to pay them more, and there should be, I forgot the figure she put out there, a $65,000 minimum salary statewide, and the state should pick up part of that. Is that the answer? Do we just have to pay them more or not?
Well, I think that would help. If you got to persuade a lot of teachers to stay in a violent, disruptive environment, you got to persuade people to come into the business in this deteriorating environment. And maybe the only way you can do it is to pay them more. I do think that just persuading them to come into this deteriorating environment is the only compelling reason to pay them more, because you can't pay them more in the belief that education is improving. It's not improving. It's been deteriorating for a couple of decades now, according to proficiency test scores. You can't raise teacher pay in the belief that education's going to improve, but you may have to raise it just to get the teacher to come to work and risk getting assaulted by mentally ill students.
Chris, final point. I did want to ask you about this next time I had you on. I don't know about you, Chris, but that story that was uncovered and picked up in thankfully most of the outlets by the state auditors, and thank God we have those folks whose eyes must be rolling back in their heads most days, about UConn. Let's give Susan Herbst, twice her salary for the sabbaticals here. And they made allegations, Chris, that this needs a deeper dive because, as usual, UConn might not be the most tidy steward of the funding it gets.
Yeah, well, I thought the auditors were a little misleading about the Herbst situation, because that Herbst was going to get a year off with her spectacular pay. That was part of her contract,
sure.
And I was writing about that years ago, and others were writing about it too. That was formally authorized by the Board of Trustees, and the auditors said, well, that violates university policy. Well, that's a technicality. The Board of Trustees voted by adopting that contract with her. They voted to waive that policy in regard to her. It was of much more concern with the other spectacular spectacularly paid professors who got these sabbaticals in contradiction of policy. Like, you're supposed to come back and teach for a year after you get your sabbatical, but apparently some of them didn't, so they just got a big retirement bonus, and that was against university policy. And of course, the university didn't do anything about it. But look, the university is notorious for its financial indifference and recklessness, and the governor and the legislature let them get away with it as long as they've got a winning basketball team.
The website, folks, check it out, chrispowellcolumn.com. Chris, good to speak with you. Have a good weekend. No one to step away from the barbecue, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Hey, thanks very much, Paul.
Appreciate it, Chris. Be good. Thanks, Chris Powell there.